The title is Talking Mushrooms, Mycopoiesis, Mycopoetics. We went on a mushroom walk this morning that was a delight, an arduous delight, as it turned out. Now we're going on a poietic walk. Let's hope that we don't come across only poisonous specimens. There we go. I say poietic rather than poetic to help break the trance of the trance-inducing word poetry. I'm interested in poetry that disrupts the trance it induces. So I often change words, distort them, torque them, place them askew or in strange places. It seems to help clear the air around them, give them some novelty and presence. I think of it as a step toward an awakened state of language listening. The more wide awake the language, the greater the options in thinking the thought. And that can mean ambiguous. Or maybe a better word is ambivalent. Going more than one way at once. We may not want to be ambivalent about mushrooms we eat or the words we use in a crisis, but in real life, we can counter both mushrooms and words to keep the situation unstable. Dogmatic intractables doesn't help. Being overly certain about a mushroom might close down necessary perception. And people who think words have God-given meaning are sometimes willing to kill over a name. The latter could use a good dose of Wittgenstein and more context awareness of words as actually used. Better to loosen up over words and meaning. It's a matter of cultivating an open ecology of mind. To use Gregory Bateson's alerting phrase, which these days carries such a sense of urgency. And this whole subject is a matter of poetics, in the sense of how a thing gets said optimally to do its work. My title here, Talking Mushrooms, Mycopoiesis, Mycopoetics, says something about the way I approach language and poetics. You could say, we're here talking mushrooms in honor of John Cage. Who's doing the talking? Would be the kind of question that comes to mind in light of his many ways of getting beyond merely personal expression. We got used to experiencing a John Cage piece with the speaker in some degree non-personal, what I sometimes call the impersona. So you could say that we're trying to experience the mushrooms doing the talking, or some such formulation, presuming a shared intelligence with nature. That raises the question of how we might make such a thing happen. The mushroom making, or mycopoiesis, and the how-to question itself is a matter of poetics, mycopoetics. I'm hardly the first to propose this sort of focus. Among present company, David Rose has written brilliantly of the poetics of the mushroom. Here we're partly in a pollen-esque domain of the botany of desire, or as Britt Bunner tweaked it, the mycology of desire, whose wily Tom Sawyer mushrooms getting us to do some of their preservational and evolutionary work. Beyond this, there is the famous claim that at least one kind of mushroom, say psilocybe mexicana, in the case of Mazatec curandera Maria Sabina, actually talks to one in one's own language. That came from Henry Munn's influential insider account in The Mushrooms of Language. And it has been academically explored in Horace Beach's 1996 dissertation, Listening for the Logos, a study of reports of audible voices at high doses of psilocybin. And he found, by the way, that one-third of the people who regularly take high-dose psilocybin hear these voices in their own voices, though they're being spoken to. And Terence McKenna was famous for having claimed that the mushroom gave him quite a lot of actual direct instruction. And of course, the famous R. Gordon Wasson account of the sessions of Baladas with Maria Sabina and the outing of psilocybin in Life magazine of May 13, 1957 led to the popular use of psychedelics and has had an outsized influence on innovative American poetry. In the mid-60s, when I was in my mid-20s, I was on the faculty of Stony Brook University and teaching a course in experimental poetry. As one of the poems I assigned, Lecture on Nothing, and to demonstrate its poetic nature, I read it aloud to the class, and I followed the rules, something we tend to do intellectually, but not literally while reading. That is, thinking the rules, but not actually enacting them. The effect was tectonic, on me, possibly more than the students, but many of most of whom had not heard of John Cage. Aside from realizing how different the effect of such a text is when following the rules, more importantly, I entered an altered state of reading, which is its own kind of altered state of consciousness. Now that may sound like an exaggeration, but it isn't. And I realized that such a process is perhaps the greatest possibility of poetry, indeed all manner of art, that with the right state of attention, the mind can undergo certain irreversible changes. The text has a literally transformative effect. New neural pathways are created.
Yeah.
Now, I already knew that poetry had this great potential to alter the range and intensity of mind experience, in part because I was also teaching a course at William Blake and considered myself a sort of disciple of his work. And nothing is more reading-altering and mind-altering than reading Blake's Jerusalem. But now I was seeing that each text has the potential for high impact, each in a completely different way. Lecture on Nothing showed how precise timing can interrupt cognitive process in a way that opens consciousness to experience an utterly new kind of reading-listening, a kind that cannot be characterized in general because it belongs completely to the moment, a singularity of one person's awareness in one specific moment. And such experience encourages the thought, a poetics of singularity. An aspect of this altered listening in Lecture on Nothing is the apophatic tendency, which Cage may have absorbed in part from one of his favorite thinkers, Meister Eckhart, the great 13th century German mystical philosopher theologian, whose sermons are often compared to Buddhist ways of thinking. The apophatic, or apophysis, literally means speaking away, and often is called negative theology. A scholar I love to read, Michael Sells, calls it unsaying, to emphasize how a discursive strategy paradoxically aims to say the unsayable, or what I would call further saying. So, lecturing on nothing produces the something that tells us the nothing, that is something vitally important in creating space for the spontaneous awareness due to nothing or silence. What kind of fresh and spontaneous awareness is this? The Lecture on Nothing is a kind of musical language trap that catches a constantly new openness to the unforeseen. It's something like a hypnotic induction into a state of awareness that turns what can be irritating into an unprecedented state of pleasurable participation. I remember my out loud reading of Lecture on Nothing as if I'm recalling a long car trip and what it was like looking out the window at the passing landscape. My memory now tells me that I was reading the words, regarded as something seen momentarily, as though from a window while traveling. If across Kansas, then of course, Kansas. I suddenly felt a little dizzy, as if I had momentarily been transported across space-time to, well, Kansas of the mind. It's a journey. And like any journey, there are all kinds of moments. Some are annoying, some startling, some instantly pleasurable. And whatever they are, they can quickly shift and even turn into their opposite. Once you're inside the vehicle, it all depends on whether you can get with being where you are, or, on the contrary, you're longing to be somewhere else. As I was reading Lecture on Nothing to my class, I wondered if I would get through the text without chickening out. I worried that I might be boring those young people and turning them against experimental writing. And then I would recall that the whole point is that people have to learn to accept disruption as a necessary part of being truly present and opening to what is new. It may be what we mean by living in such a way that life itself is our teacher. Meanwhile, I realized that I was going through what I wanted them to go through, a journey, an adventure, a psychonautic voyage in the mind. I was having my doubts and worries and disruptions and coming to terms by settling into what was unfolding right there inside Lecture on Nothing, just the way John Cage intended. You could say, I began reading the text as me and finished as another. In the aftermath, I came to realize that what I had gone through had changed me. And there was further change in ways that I would only come to understand gradually. Each such experience opens us to a further such experience. But there are no guarantees. We're very attached to our sense of well-being. And no matter how avant-garde our attunement, sooner or later we will come up against an even bigger challenge. One day, not long after my presentation of John Cage to students, I happened upon an installation on campus, a gallery room with a strange sound field. And once inside, my curiosity soon turned to a degree of alarm. The sound got so intense that I felt it might injure my ears. I wondered what kind of artist would willingly inflict such painful sound upon people. And I left the gallery with upset. It approached indignation. Once outside, I checked the posted description of the installation and learned that it was by John Cage. This was not a happy moment. There I was, promoting the value of disruption and openness, and yet having the most ordinary kind of annoyance response to a work by one of my new heroes. The new me may have shed a skin, but the old me was alive and kicking. Clearly, it was easier for me as a poet, exposed to quite a lot of innovative challenging work, to accept Lecture on Nothing as poetry than it was to accept the field of extreme sound or music as music or art. No surprise that over the years, many have taken offense at the suggestion that Cage's formal constructions of poetry. It seems that we can never stop asking questions like, what is poetry and what is music? So, here we go again. What made Lecture on Nothing poetry as I need it? To quote Cage's own statement in that lecture, referring to his own activity. How much am I willing to accept as poetry, and therefore how broad can be the definition? Let's go to some basics. A statement that carries its weight over to another being is said to communicate. Some statements carry extra weight, more than is evident. Perhaps more than the communicator realizes. Such statements have, intentionally or not, what we might call poetic force. The more they communicate, they more than communicate. They seem to engulf the listening, reading moment, and they may leave a residue, a field of attractiveness or meaningfulness. The hearer goes back for more, or simply stays with the process beyond what is reasonable or normal. And not motivated by a need for more information, but a certain something else. One communes with or within the language. One comes to feel a little different, sometimes a lot different. But different doesn't always feel all that good. No doubt, this kind of special force of language is as variable as there are different people. The lingual situation of variability is similar to that of nature. And it's hard to think about this now without seeing a connection to the issue of biodiversity. The truism that it takes all kinds only seems to change in the extent and depth to which we're willing to understand it. basic fearfulness in people
that turns into bigotry,
racism, and sexism is fully present in our so-called aesthetic responses. If we're mindful of our own reactions, we can get a glimpse of the complexity of the problem. And it seems that as soon as we are self-shamed into a wider view, we meet a new challenge that proves the importance of accurate discrimination. Less things go very wrong, and life starts to lose its contours. In fact, fungi are no doubt one of the greatest teachers. Our delight in diversity raises the bar on the vital importance of precise criticality. Blake's Proverb of Health says, "No bird soars too high if he soars with his own wings." This suggests a principle of natural regulation, self-regulation. If only we would act upon being who we really are. John Cage's interest in Thoreau as a basic anarchism seems a fine instance of such thinking. And as the sharp thinking of both Blake and Cage show, an embrace of a principle of self-regulation hardly obviates the necessity for discriminating awareness. Au contraire, a strong dynamic in Cage's writing happens as a zone of discrimination between systematic organization and what comes up in the process. The latter can be anything from personal stories or simple preference to sudden insight and indeed what can be called visionary awareness. The latter is problematic because it might tend toward the habitual and safely repetitive. Cage didn't seem to think improvisation could escape such hidden patterning, so he relied on procedures intended to bypass the ego. It obviously worked well for him and for Jackson the club. It never worked for me, no matter how many times I tried it. Yet, when I listened to John reading a text like Empty Words, which Susan and I had the honor of publishing part of in the early 70s, or for that matter, Jackson the club reading stanzas for Iris Lizak, I sometimes entered a state approaching ecstasy. It always sent me sailing in the mind. Once when John read part two of Empty Words in New York City, each part takes about 2.5 hours, and had slides of Thoreau's drawings from the margins of the journals flashing large on the screen, I actually grew a bit suspicious. Although appearing quite abstract when projected, the images seemed way too meaningfully tied to the unfolding text to be pure chance. Was John cheating on his own resolve? Or was I half hoping he'd come around to my way of working? Afterwards, I went up to him and said how astonished I was at the convergence of image and text. And he said, "Isn't the good Lord marvelous?" John treasured participation in nature in its mode of operation, which seems to be a reading of Aristotle's Mimesis. Thoreau was a nature hero of that interest. Human intervention in environment needs sensitive awareness so as not to pervert the course of natural justice, where excessive human ego may be seen as the source of our big troubles. The main question is how to refine our grasp of the root principles operative in nature. There are many perspectives on this question that John enjoyed, such as Bucky Fuller's Synergetics and Tensegrity. If he were alive today, John might rejoice in a recent physics version of nature self-regulation called self-organized criticality, which, when related to the understanding that underlies his computational systematics, seems right. Self-organized criticality unites two concepts. Self-organization is a process where some form of order arises out of a random system, and criticality, where a system reaches a critical point of change or determination, like water freezing 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So, how does criticality work with self-organization? Well, you never know. until after the fact. Let's look at this complex idea simplistically for a moment. Self-organized criticality means unpredictability in a dynamic system. An example is the weather, where prediction is always approximate at best and can go terribly wrong suddenly, likewise earthquakes. The famous example is piling sand higher and higher and higher until one last grain causes it to break into a landslide. This principle applies to a vast number of situations, recently observed to include certain phenomena in the human brain that none of our brain mapping can account for. Then there's the arising and disappearing of species, and we're back to mushrooms, where the conditions of their appearance and disappearance are profoundly mysterious. And one of the many factors that make that true, this human interaction with their ecosystems, no matter how much we try to control things, the results tend toward self-organized criticalities. Because we are embodiments of the principle, like it or not. Examples of self-organized criticality often inspire fear, but it's also an opportunity for spontaneous new perception of order. Our sudden insights during a caged, chance-generated text could be thought of as evidence of such self-organization, where a true insight is a critical threshold of a new awareness. The process of meaning is sudden, spontaneous. It happens on its own. The language may be subjected to a system, but our experience within it is unpredictable, free, and self-determining. It inspires an imaginative experience of our intrinsic self-organization. Furthermore, the language in which we think about these problems and attempt to make our concepts foolproof is also up against its own deep self-organization with hidden criticalities. Cage's work reflects this situation, a fixed system where, on the inside, the language is wild. That's one way you could say he works nature in its mode of operation. Maybe the mushrooms in part because they're so obviously that way. The experientially unlimited variety of mushrooms suggests a further connection with poietic variability and a need for an open poetics. There's no hope of encompassing the field. There's the awe-inspiring fact that of the possibly 2 to 3 billion plus fungi, of which a mere 120,000 or so have been classified, and due to genetic analysis, even more classifications have been all going sort of haywire. Authority cannot hold its ground forever. In fact, the intrusive and even dangerous nature of authority is nowhere more evident. Human intervention in nature and language is consequential. Human cultivated species from dogs to shrooms contribute to the natural world, and that includes inventive language, which I'm addressing as poiesis. I'm thinking biodiversity, logodiversity, and including glossodiversity, spoken intervention in the environment. We are co-created with nature, and that means co-evolution. To some extent, we co-configure, reconfigure reality as we go. And the way we do this with language, I call linguality, reality-generating language. This puts poiesis as both a natural human process and an art form at the center of evolutionary process. Already in the late 60s, and well before my experience with entheogens, I was committed to intrinsic diversity in poiesis. In looking for ways to explore that beyond what was available, for instance, my friend Jerome Rothenberg had just finished editing the anthology Technicians of the Sacred in 1968, where poets used the resources of experimental poetries to do a new kind of translation from indigenous world poetries, which I published parts of in my magazine Stony Brook, 1968. So, for that issue, I asked him to be an editor of the new field, to use ethnos and poetics in a way like ethnomusicology, and he settled on ethnopoetics. I was also taken by the work of John Lilly on dolphins. and heard that secretly he had used mescaline in researching human connection with dolphins. Rumor was that his associate had had sex with a dolphin on mescaline, those ultra-random creatures so like the human mind. And I heard a tape of Roger Payne's amazing recording of humpback whales, again in 1968. And I began to fantasize about interspecies communication and what kind of poetics that might generate. Xenopoetics? I also thought ecopoetics, but I couldn't find a possible editor at that point, and it has since become an important field. Just thinking about all that began to change my own poetics. Now, to declare mushroom languaging a domain of poetics is not like an act of science or religion, which would mean thinking to resolve ultimate issues. It resolves nothing. And it's not a way of privileging poetry over other forms of discourse. It creates a kind of meta-narrative, allowing us to speak outside existing frames and aim to see the issues anew, a thinking act of reframing. Rational discrimination and refocused imagination can work together by oscillating focus. That kind of reframing shifts attention to the fact that we are always languaging what we see, and how we do that matters, as a feedback factor that informs us. Blake said, we become what we behold. We see the world the way we language it. If I give mushrooms a dangerous lingual aura, I will draw back internally when seeing them. If I call psychoactive ones entheogens rather than drugs, especially schedule one like a narcotic, I will open my mind to some aspect of their possible transformative effect, even if I don't plan to take them into my body. I may see history and art somewhat differently. Carl Ruck, Gordon Wasson, Albert Hoffman in their book, The Road to Eleusis, shifted our sense of history rather dramatically, implausibly arguing that the ergotamine precursor to LSD derived from Claviceps purpurea, and that was the psychoactive substance in the Eleusinian mysteries. That's the oldest mysteries that are known to exist among human beings. And that road leads through ethnomycology to ethnopoetics. We know that power, as power over others, extends itself by intimidation. And one of those powerful acts is to demonize. Like state power, some religions do it to get a tighter grip on us. And powerful substances are classified negatively to engender fear. Fear of the substance and of the legal consequences of using it. The social taboo and the general atmosphere around entheogens is no doubt, in large part, an outcome of the situation of intimidation. This is where I should acknowledge the brave forthrightness of Panjai Magazine to have taken this on so thoroughly, and of David Rose for having seen the art importance of mushrooms and language. And I'm grateful for David's unprecedented, insightful remarks on my early work, Ethnopoetics, Somapoetics. His writing in Finnegan's Wake and mushrooms, for instance, stirred my imagination in a way that reminded me of how Gordon Wasson's Soma Divine Mushroom of Immortality did when I was 28, when I had recently taken mescaline for the first time. While mescaline is not from a mushroom, but a cactus, and in the form I took it, not even organic, it had a resonance with mushrooms that would unfold over the years. And eventually, after I met my lifelong partner and muse, Susan, would become in the 1973 work called Somapoetics, and continues to extend my work of the past 20 years, Preverbs, now in its 12th book, Plausibly Attract, as an example. A couple of years before that mushroom-bound turning point, while writing a long sequence called Of a Woman, the Earthboard Key, I awoke from a dream to write down what call themselves the four proverbs of Soma. This is 1968. I had no idea what Soma meant, beyond the more obvious link to the Greek sense of body. But my LaRousse Encyclopedia of Mythology clued me into the Vedic god with the further sense of a unique edible god associated with poetry, song, and ecstatic states of mind. So Wasson's book, 2 years later, had startling resonance. His assertion that Soma was a mushroom, indeed, in particular, Amanita muscaria, set my imagination galloping. Due both to the previously received proverbs of Soma and to the interim entheogenic encounter. Now, for just a few words about that life-changing experience in 1970, which is the sort of thing one thinks would be better told as a movie. Having taken the mescaline, I entered a totally dark room where, during the first couple of hours, I learned why Eros was considered a daimon, which, according to Plato, meant a link between humans and the gods. Then, at a certain point, I suddenly looked up and realized that I was inside Blake's painting, Dante beholding Beatrice in the star car, also known as Beatrice addressing Dante from the car, the painting from 1824 to 1827. And here, it was not only happening in the present, but I was happening inside it. I laughed out loud at the overwhelming and unanticipated beauty of art in its nature as a complete realm of being. And you can actually get inside it. So now I knew that art, in Blake's sense, is not simply about things, not just metaphoric in any familiar sense, but as a way into and through the dimensions of being, a kind of membrane offering access to the possible. I was quite sure that the art domain would never be the same for me, and that the view of art as a gate into the unknown possible has persisted all these years. But as I realized that fateful night, this had been happening already, and it took this dramatic occasion to bring the message home. Reading Blake had been an essential initiation. Teaching John Cage's lecture on nothing had offered an early experience of art processed as psychonautic, indeed glossonautic, a journey through the portal of language process in its further speaking. And most important was the fact that I had been writing a series of poems called Torsion Poems. After the way they kept shifting their grammatical function unexpectedly, which I and others thought may be signs of mental disorder. And now, under the entheogenic influence, I could understand it in an entirely new way. Language seemed to be putting itself under pressure to reveal something other. The key moment came when, after leaving my dark room of solitary vision, I asked my cousin John, who was also experiencing the altered state for the first time, if I could read him one of those poems that had been troubling me. And as I was reading it, partway through, he stopped me and said, "Are you sure you wrote that? I think I wrote that." So what I call my poem did not actually belong to me. It was a lingual membrane between minds, offering an open opportunity to learn how we're interconnected as beings. It might now be called, following the Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, a medium of interbeing. It's all a lecture on nothing that stands transformatively between us, provided that we can enter a state of enhanced listening. It steps up the intensity of our eco-proprioception, my word for sensing oneself as including others. A few years ago, Laura Kuhn created an opportunity for a small group of us to experience John Cage's empty words the way he thought was best, as a continuous performance. In this case, through recordings of Cage, in four sessions of the four parts, lasting all night until dawn. I first knew of this possibility of its performance back in the very early 70s, when I had been asked to organize an experimental art festival in Stony Brook, and I asked John if he would like to do something. He offered to do the all-nighter version of Empty Words, and so we made plans. Unfortunately, the festival fell through, and I had to call him to apologize. And I said, "I feel terrible, John. You made all these preparations and we let you down." He replied, "Well, it was a good thing anyway, because I stopped smoking to do it." I knew I could never last all night if I needed to smoke. I never got to be present for the couple of times that John did perform Empty Words that way. And so Laura's event was a deeply appreciated gift and the fulfillment of something critical in my life values. We were told that it was okay to bring what we needed for napping, but I decided that listening awake was the better choice. And once again, I got to experience John Cage's language world as a journey into the marvels of unknown lingualia, my name for reality-generating language. It's in that dimension of experience that I came to understand over the years how John could regard his work in music as equivalent to Zen practice. The inseparability of art and meditative practice, despite some conventional views, is a potentially high order of both domains. You could say that language and sound, practiced at a certain level of intense listening, are potentially entheogenic and in ways not well understood. One way of looking at culture is to see it as an elaborate disguise for the radically unknown. John Cage's musical language procedures poke holes in the costumes. For the uninitiated, the results were something like alien language. I experienced that in 1974 when we were both teaching at the first summer of Europa Institute, later university. And he read part four of Empty Words on the mistaken assumption that meditators would enjoy the sparse text in lots of silences and open spaces. Instead, after 15 or so minutes of a 2.5-hour performance, the large audience went wild with strumming guitars and shouts and near threats to his physical presence. I was recording the event, and inside the soundproof booth, I was apparently the only person who heard the whole sublime performance. As the mic picked up mainly his voice and very little of the rowdy din of the out-of-control audience. This is one of several times John Cage changed my life. He enunciated the text as impeccably as ever. The incredible poise and devotion to principled performative perfection in the face of actual danger taught me what comprises a truly heroic stance in art. It was an act of high art, and it still guides me in its resonant residue. We the people are profoundly hesitant before the unfamiliar, the untamed, the unconstrained, the alien, seeing it as what Freud called the unheimlich, the uncanny. And yet, we seek it out in so many ways. Sometimes the titillation or shock, as with strange tales and horror films, or else as conscious inquiry, possibly as a doorway to our own unknown nature, or some degree of ecstatic experience beyond the limitations of self. The latter fits my own experience of Cage's work, or Blake's, or the path of poesis that has guided my life, a path with its own wilderness. And nothing in nature fits that inclination quite the way fungi do. The great third kingdom, now known to be genetically liminal to plants and animals, and somehow suggestive of mind itself. Does anything resemble the human neurotic network more than the great earth internet of mycelia? If Ruck, Wasson, Hoffman, McKenna, and so many more are even partly right, that kingdom between and its entheogens stand for the secret dimension of human engagement with the mysterious roots of language and consciousness. Traditionary esoterics have attempted to preserve and enhance such awareness. I see this whole domain as one of the keys to our sense of self as including other, meaning earth, nature, other being, perhaps even the radically alien. What I have been writing about recently as eco-proprioception, the self-knowing that includes the field of being, the psychobiology of interbeing, what draws us to interact with the world as ourselves. Mushrooms speak to us mainly by being what they are in our field of awareness. They educate our attention in new ways. I call fungi a literal metaphor, something which calls us to study it as if it tells us something about Earth nature, our nature, the roots of our existence, the mycelia of our thinking. It extends meaning by being rather than the other. And yet, it's connected to us. And the psychogenic mushroom literalizes this further and shows us what we are far beyond how we normally think we are. It weaves into our poiesis, how we speak reality, and that can get quite strange in the way we are strange even to ourselves. Heraclitus says, we are estranged from what is most familiar. When I'm inside my daily practice of working with language, I am furthering what I can only know in the way it tells me. Its intrinsic indeterminacy is self-articulate. It says itself. Historically, many poets have reported this experience of internal guidance from within the language of the unfolding poem. Like I said, it's a trip. It's nautical. Psychonautics, as logonautics, has kinship with myconautics. Why is it so startling that psilocybin should speak to us in our own language, in a voice like but not the same as our own? The poem does. Empty words do. Perhaps the strangeness of what is closest comes of our forgetfulness of nature in its mode of operation as including us, the mind, its language. A poem like Cage's Empty Words functions as an entity that speaks by taking on your own vocal mind. A poetry is like a foreign language. We have to learn it. And like mushroom hunting, that takes time, patience, and ongoing committed experience. It works best when we take up residence in the country. Is the poetry in the poem or in the mind, reading the poem? Such a crazy question pries open the complexity of the issue. When we were publishing Cage's Themes and Variations in the early 80s at Satiable Press near here, I had to call him up with technical questions, and I did so with trepidation about disturbing him. I said, "Hi, John, I hope I'm not interrupting you." Laughing, he replied, "Oh, that's all right. That's what we do for each other." Such a simple, fresh, unexpected, lighthearted response. Later I realized it had changed something for me, much as a poem can. Cajun humor is a species unto itself, and an open-hearted laugh has signature singularity. His humor showed a certain hilaritas, a virtue that helps make his disruptions take root, nurture, and renew. So, was John's phone response an act of poetry? Is the poem in the voice, in the text, in the heart, in the mind, in the laugh, in the talking mushroom, flesh of the gods? Is it like a virus, as William Burroughs said language is? And did it infect me at age 14 and doom my life to low-income ecstasy? Is it the further evolution of language that, as McKenna claimed in his stoned ape hypothesis, first came to us from the intergalactic spores carrying consciousness wherever it can take root? Is poiesis a step toward the xenolinguistics, the study of alien languages, which Diana Slattery has so articulately advanced in recent years? Is poiesis the root entheogen acting at the forefront of our evolutionary partnership with mushrooms,
the ecophilia that Richard Doyle so attractively lays out in his Darwin's Pharmacy, Sex, Plants, and the Evolution of the Noosphere? Is it too late for us to get through this alien portal, trapped as we are in our own poem?
Ha 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 ha!